Kitty, Chapter 20. Over several weeks, Kitty met regularly with Mr. Pennifeather and his friends at Seven Dials, at other coffee shops scattered across central London, and at Mr. Pennifeather's flat above his artist supply shop in a busy street just south of the river. Each time she learned more about the group and their objectives. Each time she found herself identifying with them more closely. It seemed that Mr. Pennifeather had assembled his company haphazardly, relying on word of mouth and reports in newspapers to lead him to people with unusual capabilities. Some months he haunted the courtrooms, looking for someone such as Kitty. Otherwise he simply used taproom chat to single out interesting rumours of people who had survived magical disaster. His art shop was modestly successful. Generally he left it in the hands of his assistants, and prowled through London on his surreptitious errands. His followers had joined him over a long period of time. Anne, a vivacious woman of 40, had met him almost 15 years before. They were veterans of many campaigns together. Gladys, the blonde woman from the café, was in her 20s. She had withstood a side blast from a magician's duel 10 years earlier, when still a girl. She and Nicholas, a stocky young man with a brooding manner, had worked for Mr. Pennifeather since they were children. The rest of the company were younger, no one older than 18. Kitty and Stanley, both 13, were the youngest of all. The old man dominated them all with his presence, which was at once inspiring and autocratic. His willpower was iron-strong, and his mental energies untiring, but his body was gradually failing him, and this roused him to outbursts of incoherent fury. In the early days such occasions were rare, and Kitty listened intently to his impassioned accounts of the great struggle in which they were engaged. Ordinarily, Mr. Pennifeather argued, it was impossible to resist the magicians or their rule. They did exactly what they pleased, as all the company had discovered to their cost. They ran everything important: the government, the civil service, the biggest businesses, and the newspapers. Even the plays on at the theatres had to be officially sanctioned in case they contained subversive messages. And while the magicians enjoyed the luxuries of their rule, everyone else, the vast majority, got on with providing the essential services the magicians required. They worked in the factories, ran the restaurants, fought in the army. If it involved real work, the commoners did it, and providing they did it quietly, the magicians left them alone. But if there was even the smallest hint of dissatisfaction, the magicians came down hard. Their spies were everywhere. One word out of place and you were whisked off for interrogation in the tower. Many troublemakers disappeared for good. The magician's power made it impossible to rebel. They controlled dark forces that few had glimpsed, but which everyone feared. But Mr. Pennifeather's company, this small handful of souls gathered up and driven forward by his implacable hatred, was more fortunate than most, and its good fortune came in several forms. To some degree, all of Mr. Pennifeather's friends shared his resilience to magic, but how far this stretched was impossible to say. Because of his past, it was clear Mr. Pennifeather could withstand a fairly strong attack. Most of the others, such as Kitty, had only been gently tested so far. Some of them—these were Anne, Eva, Martin, and the surly and pockmarked Fred—had another talent. Since early childhood, they had each regularly observed small demons travelling hither and thither through the streets of London. Some flew, others walked among the crowds. No one else noticed them, and upon investigation it appeared that to most people the demons were either invisible or masked by disguise. According to Martin, who worked in a paint factory and was, after Mr. Pennifeather, the most fiery and passionate, a good many cats and pigeons were not what they seemed. Eva, brown curly hair, 15, still at school, said she had once seen a stickle-backed demon walk into a grocer's and buy a bunch of garlic. Her mother, who was with her, had seen nothing but a bent old lady doing her shopping. Penetrating illusions in this way was a trait that came in very useful to Mr. Pennifeather. Another ability that he highly prized was that of Stanley, a chipper, rather cocksure boy, who, despite being Kitty's age, had already left school. He worked delivering newspapers. Stanley could not see demons. Instead, he was able to perceive a faint, flickering radiance given off by any object containing magical force. As a small boy, he had so delighted in these auras that he had taken to stealing the objects concerned. By the time Mr. Pennifeather caught up with him, at the judicial courts, he was already an accomplished pickpocket. Anne and Gladys had a similar ability, but it was not nearly so marked as that of Stanley, who could sense magical items through clothes, and even behind thin wooden partitions. As a result, Stanley was one of the key figures of Mr. Pennyfeather's company. Instead of seeing magical activity, the gentle, quiet Timothy seemed able to hear it. As far as he could describe it, he sensed a kind of humming in the air. "Like a bell ringing," he said when pressed, "or the sound you get when you tap an empty glass." If he concentrated, and if there wasn't too much other noise around, he could actually trace the hum to its source, perhaps a demon or a magical object of some kind. When all these abilities were set together, Mr. Pennyfeather said, they formed a small but effective force to set against the might of the magicians. It could not declare itself openly, of course, but it could work to undercut their enemies. Magical objects could be traced, hidden dangers could be avoided, and most importantly of all, attacks could be made on the magicians and their wicked servants. From the first, these revelations enthralled Kitty. She observed Stanley as, on a training day, he picked out a magical knife from 6 ordinary specimens, each one concealed from him in a separate cardboard box. She followed Timothy as he walked back and forth through Mr. Pennyfeather's shop, locating the resonance of a jeweled necklace that had been hidden in a pot of brushes. Magical objects were at the center of the company's strategy. Kitty regularly observed members of the group arriving at the shop with small parcels or bags that they passed to Anne, Mr. Pennyfeather's second-in-command, to be stowed quietly away. These contained stolen goods.
"Kitty," Mr. Pennyfeather said to her one evening, "I have studied our verminous leaders for 30 years, and I believe I have learned their biggest weakness. They are greedy for everything. Money, power, status, you name it, and quarrel incessantly about them all. But nothing arouses their passions more than magical trinkets."
She nodded.
"Magic rings and bracelets, you mean?"
"Doesn't have to be jewellery," Anne said.
She and Eva were with them in the back room of the shop, sitting beside stacked rolls of paper.
"Might be anything. Staves, pots, lamps, pieces of wood. That moolah glass we chucked at you. That counts as one, doesn't it, Chief?"
"It does indeed, which is why we stole it, which is why we steal all these things whenever we can."
"I think that glass came from the house in Chelsea, didn't it?"
Anne said.
"The one where Eva and Stanley shinned up the drainpipe to the upstairs window, while the party was going on at the front of the house."
Kitty was open-mouthed.
"Isn't that terribly dangerous? Aren't magicians' houses protected by all sorts of things?"
Mr. Pennyfeather nodded.
"Yes, though it depends on the power of the magician concerned. That one merely had magical tripwires laced across the room. Naturally, Stanley evaded them easily. We got a good cluster of objects that day."
"And what do you do with them?" Kitty asked. "Apart from throwing them at me, that is."
Mr. Pennyfeather smiled.
"Artifacts are a major source of every magician's power. Minor officials, such as the Assistant Secretary for Agriculture, I think he was the owner of the moolah glass, can only afford weak objects, while the greatest men and women aspire to rare pieces of terrible force. They all do so because they are decadent and lazy. It is much easier to use a magical ring to strike down a foe than it is to summon some demon from the pit to do it."
"Safer, too,"
Eva said.
"Quite. So you see, Kitty, the more items we can get hold of, the better. It weakens the magicians considerably."
"And we can use them instead," Kitty added promptly. Mr. Pennyfeather paused.
"Opinion is a little divided on this. Eva here," he curled his lip back slightly, showing his teeth, "Eva believes it is morally dangerous to follow too closely in the magician's footsteps. She believes the items should be destroyed. I, however, and it is my company, is it not, so my word goes, believe that we must use whatever weapons we can against such enemies, and that includes turning their own magic against them."
Eva shifted in her seat.
"It seems to me, Kitty," she said, "that by using such things we become no better than the magicians themselves. It's far better to remain detached from the temptations of evil things."
"Ha!"
The old man gave a disparaging snort.
"How else can we undermine our rulers? We need direct attacks to destabilize the government. Sooner or later the people will rise up in support of us."
"Well, when?" Eva said. There's been no—
"We do not study magic like the magicians," Mr. Pennyfeather interrupted. "We are in no moral danger. But by doing a little research, a little reading in stolen books, for instance, we can learn to operate basic weapons. Your moolah glass, Kitty, that only required a simple Latin command. This is enough for small demonstrations of our displeasure. The more complex artifacts we can stockpile safely out of magicians' hands."
"I think we're going about it the wrong way," Eva said quietly. "A few little explosions will never make any difference. They'll always be stronger. We—"
Mr. Pennyfeather slammed his stick hard upon his workbench, making both Eva and Kitty jump.
"Would you rather do nothing?" he yelled. "Very well. Go back out among the herds of sheep. Put your head down and waste your lives."
"I didn't mean that. I just don't see—"
"My shop is closing. It is late. You are no doubt expected home, Miss Jones."
Kitty's mother and father had been greatly relieved by her prompt payment of the court fine. In keeping with their incurious personalities, they did not inquire too closely into where the money came from, gratefully accepting Kitty's stories about a generous benefactor and a fund for miscarriages of justice. In some surprise, they watched Kitty's gradual detachment from her old habits, as throughout the summer holidays she spent more and more time with her new friends in Southwark. Her father, in particular, did not hide his satisfaction.
"You're better off keeping away from that Herneck boy," he said. "He'll only get you into trouble again."
Although Kitty continued to visit Jacob, her visits were generally brief and unsatisfactory. Jacob's strength was a long time returning, and his mother kept sharp vigil at his bedside, sending Kitty packing as soon as she detected exhaustion in her son. Kitty could not tell him about Mr. Pennyfeather, and Jacob, for his part, was preoccupied with his streaked and itching face. He grew inward-looking, and perhaps, Kitty thought, slightly resentful of her health and energy. Gradually her trips to the Herneck household became less frequent, and after some months they ceased. Two things kept Kitty involved with the company. Firstly, gratitude for the payment of her fine. She felt herself to be under a definite obligation to Mr. Pennyfeather. For all that he never mentioned it again, it was possible that the old man sensed her feelings on the matter. If so, he did not attempt to gainsay them. The second reason was in many ways the more important. Kitty wanted to learn more about the resilience that Mr. Pennyfeather had discovered in her, and find out what it could do. Joining the company seemed the only way of achieving this. It also promised her a direction, a sense of purpose, and the glamour of a small and secret society hidden from the world at large. It was not long before she was accompanying the others out on foraging expeditions. At first she was an onlooker, keeping watch while Fred or Eva scrawled anti-government graffiti on walls, or broke into magicians' cars and houses in search of artifacts. Kitty would stand in the shadows, fingering the silver pendant in her pocket, ready to whistle at any sign of danger. Later, she accompanied Gladys or Stanley as they followed magicians home, tracing the aura of the objects they carried. Kitty noted down the addresses in preparation for later raids. Occasionally, late in the evening, she would observe Fred or Martin departing the shop on missions of a different kind. They wore dark clothes, their faces smudged with soot. They carried small, heavy bags under their arms. No one referred openly to their objectives, but when the next morning's newspaper carried reports of unexplained attacks on government properties, Kitty drew her own conclusions. In time, because she was intelligent and decisive, Kitty began to assume a more prominent role. It was Mr. Pennyfeather's practice to send his friends out in small groups, within which each member had a different job. After some months, he let Kitty take charge of one such group, consisting of Fred, Stanley, and Eva. Fred's mulish aggression and Eva's outspoken opinions were notoriously incompatible, but Kitty managed to harness their characters with such effectiveness that they returned from a tour of the magician's warehouses with several choice prizes, including a couple of large blue orbs, which Mr. Pennyfeather said were possibly elemental spheres, very rare and valuable. For Kitty, time spent away from the company soon became infinitely tedious. She grew steadily more contemptuous of the small-minded outlook of her parents and the propaganda fed to her at school. By contrast, she revelled in the excitement of the company's nightly operations, but these were fraught with risk. One evening a magician discovered Kitty and Stanley clambering out of his study window with a magical box in their grasp. He summoned a small creature in the shape of a stoat, which pursued them, belching gouts of fire from its open mouth. Eva, waiting in the street below, threw a moolah glass at the demon, which, distracted by the appearance of the moolah, halted for a moment, allowing them to get away. On another occasion, in a magician's garden, Timothy was assailed by a sentry demon, which crept up and embraced him with its thin blue fingers. It would have gone badly for him had Nick not managed to lop off the creature's head with an antique sword he had stolen moments before. Because of his resilience, Timothy survived, but complained thereafter of a faint odour he could never shift. Aside from demons, the police were a continual problem, and eventually led to disaster. As the company's thefts grew more ambitious, greater numbers of night police appeared on the streets. One autumn evening in Trafalgar Square, Martin and Stanley noticed a disguised demon carrying an amulet that gave off a vibrant, magical pulse. The creature made off on foot, but left a strong resonance in its wake, which Tim was able to follow with ease. It was soon cornered in a quiet alley, where the company weathered the demon's most ferocious assaults. Unfortunately, this magical outburst attracted the attentions of the night police. Kitty and her colleagues scattered, pursued by things that resembled a pack of dogs. The following day, all but one reported back to Pennyfeather. That one was Tim, who was never seen again. Timothy's loss hit the company hard, and resulted in a second, almost immediate casualty. Several of the group, Martin and Stanley in particular, called loudly for a more audacious strategy against the magicians.
"We could lie in wait in Whitehall," Martin said, "when they're driving into Parliament, or hit Devereux when he leaves his palace at Richmond. That'll shake 'em up, if the PM goes. We need something seismic now to start the uprising."
"Not yet," Mr. Pennyfeather said testily. "I need to do more research. Now get out and leave me in peace."
He was a slight boy, Martin, with dark eyes and a thin, straight nose, and an intensity about him that Kitty had never noticed in anyone before. He had lost his parents to the magicians, someone said, but Kitty never learned the circumstances. He never looked anyone full in the eyes while speaking, always a little down and to the side. Whenever Mr. Pennyfeather refused his demands for action, he would argue his case passionately at first, then suddenly withdraw into himself, blank-faced, as if unable to express the strength of his feelings. A few days after Tim's death, Martin did not turn up for the evening's patrol. When Mr. Pennyfeather entered his cellar, he discovered that his secret weapons store had been opened. An elemental sphere had been taken. Hours later, an attack on Parliament took place. An elemental sphere was thrown into the midst of the MPs, killing several people. The Prime Minister himself narrowly escaped. Sometime the next day, the body of a youth was washed up on the shingle of the Thames. Almost overnight, Mr. Pennyfeather became more solitary and irritable, rarely visiting the shop except on resistance business. Anne reported that he was throwing himself deeper into his researches in the stolen books of magic.
"He wants to access better weapons," she said. "We've only scratched the surface before. We need greater knowledge if we're to get revenge for Tim and Martin."
"How can he manage that?"
Kitty protested. She had liked Tim particularly, and the loss had affected her deeply.
"Those books are written in 100 languages. He'll never make head or tail of them." "He's made a contact," Anne said. "Someone who can help us out."
And indeed, it was around this time that a new associate joined the group. Mr. Pennyfeather valued his opinions highly.
"Mr. Hopkins is a scholar," he said,
on introducing him to the group for the first time.
"A man of great wisdom. He has many insights into the cursed ways of the magicians."
"I do my best," Mr. Hopkins said modestly.
"He works as a clerk at the British Library,"
Mr. Pennyfeather went on, clapping him on the shoulder.
"I was nearly caught when trying to, appropriate a book on magic. Mr. Hopkins shielded me from the guards, allowed me to escape. I was grateful. We began talking. I have never met a commoner with so much knowledge. He has taught himself many things by reading the texts there. Sadly, his brother was killed by a demon years ago, and like us, he seeks revenge. He knows how many languages, Clem?"
14, Mr. Hopkins said, "and 7 dialects."
"There, how about that? He does not have resilience as we do, sadly, but he can provide backup support."
"I'll do what I can," Mr. Hopkins said. Whenever Kitty tried to bring Mr. Hopkins to mind, she found it was an oddly difficult task. It wasn't that he was unusual in any way. Quite the opposite, in fact. He was extremely ordinary. His hair, perhaps, was straight and mousy. His face was smooth, clean-shaven. It was hard to say if he was old or young. He had no standout features, no funny quirks or unusual ways of speaking. All in all, there was something so instantly forgettable about the man himself that even in his company, as he was actually speaking, she would find herself switching off him, listening to the words, but ignoring the speaker. It was a decidedly curious thing. Mr. Hopkins was treated with some suspicion by the company at first, primarily because, lacking resilience, he did not go out on forays to bring artifacts home. Instead, his forte was information, and in this he quickly proved his worth to the group at large. His job at the library, together perhaps with his oddly unmemorable character, allowed him to eavesdrop on the magicians. As a result, he was often able to predict their movements, allowing raids to be carried out on their property while they were away. He heard tell of artifacts newly sold by pins, enabling Mr. Pennyfeather to organize appropriate burglaries. Above all, Mr. Hopkins uncovered a wider range of incantations, allowing new weapons to be used in a wider range of resistance attack. The accuracy of his tips was such that soon everyone came to rely on him implicitly. Mr. Pennyfeather was still the group's leader, but Mr. Hopkins's intelligence was their guiding light. Time passed. Kitty left school at the standard age of 15. She had what few qualifications the school provided, but saw no future in the joyless factory work or the secretarial jobs offered by the authorities. An agreeable alternative presented itself. At Mr. Pennyfeather's suggestion, and to the satisfaction of her parents, she became an assistant, working in his art shop. Among 100 other tasks, she learned to keep the ledger, cut watercolour paper, and sort brushes into a dozen varieties of bristle. Mr. Pennyfeather did not pay well, but Kitty was content enough. At first, she enjoyed the danger of her activities with the company. She liked the warm and secret thrill she got when passing government workers struggling to paint over some graffitied slogan, or see an outraged headline in the Times complaining about the latest thefts. After a few months, to escape her parents' scrutiny, she rented a small room in a run-down tenement, 5 minutes from the shop. She kept long hours, working in the shop by day and with the company at night. Her complexion grew pale, her eyes hardened by the perpetual threat of exposure and repeated loss. Each year came further casualties. Eva, killed by a demon at a house in Mayfair, her resilience unable to withstand its attack. Gladys lost during a warehouse blaze when a dropped sphere started a fire. As the company contracted, there came a sudden sense that the authorities were striving to hunt them down. A new magician named Mandrake was active. Demons in the guise of children were seen, making inquiries about the resistance and offering magical goods for sale. Human informers appeared in pubs and cafes, flourishing pound notes in return for information. There was a beleaguered air to the meetings in the back room of Mr. Pennyfeather's shop. The old man's health was waning. He was irritable, and his lieutenants restless. Kitty could see that a crisis was coming. Then came the fateful meeting, and the biggest challenge of all.